Kelly Leonard is a semi-regular guest here on WGN Radio. He joins us as the Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at The Second City. And he's the host of Getting to Yes and a podcast we host here at WGNRadio.com and that you can find everywhere, as you can with all great podcasts. Hi, Kelly Leonard.
Hi, John Williams.
Before we get to the reason you're here today, you said this about George Wendt after he passed. The outpouring of love for George Wendt speaks volumes as to the brilliance and character of this man. He was kind, funny, and talented. All gifts he shared with folks of all stripes. His generosity never discriminated. And if you think he seemed like a guy you wanted to get a beer with, you were right. Rest in peace, George. Did you work with him sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those alumni who transcended the generations. He always came back for the anniversaries. He talked to everyone. He, you know, I was telling Scott Simon this on NPR that, you know, when I was a dishwasher, George Wendt gave me the time of day, and he gave me the same time of the day when I was a producer. There was no difference.
Yeah. I noticed Chris Jones in the Tribune talked about he was one of those guys that came back.
Yeah.
And I suppose plenty of them do, but he was certainly in that pantheon. And Jones also suggested that maybe the shout norm, wherever he went, may have grated on him, but he never led on to that. He sort of appreciated the entree that gave him, even though that defined him.
Yeah, it was a journey. He didn't like it at first. And I distinctly remember friends like Tim Kazurinsky, who was a great pal of his, you know, offering that it should be a reframe because people loved Norm. And let's be honest, there was a lot of George in Norm.
You also were talking to me just off the air briefly. This is the hot topic around this station the last few days. Mm. The rehearsal, Nathan Fielder,
yeah.
That crazy guy, actually was on CNN just a little while ago talking about transportation. He was being interviewed on CNN with a transportation editor about cockpit safety, which is, in essence, the thrust of this latest six-part series, the second season, six episodes. Have you seen that show?
Yeah, I just started watching it.
Have you finished it?
No.
What episode are you on?
I just finished one.
Got it.
He's a genius, and he's one of these people like Sacha Baron Cohen who seemingly crosses a line. So you're sort of like, are we making fun of these people? Are we having fun at their expense? But also, are we revealing certain kinds of truths, and are we thinking about things in different ways, which is important as well?
And my answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
Is that yours?
Yeah, and it totally relates to the conversation we're going to have about my guest on the podcast this week.
So you interviewed Christopher DiCarlo from the University of Toronto?
Yep.
What's the title of his book?
He's got a new book called Building a God, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence and the Race to Control It.
Okay, what's that about?
Well, spoiler alert, he says there's absolutely a chance the robots are going to kill us. All of us. So my last question for every new guest on the podcast is to ask, I ask them to prepare a yes and story. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, sometimes they just riff. He didn't prepare one. And the idea with the yes and story, of course, the podcast is called Getting to Yes And. In improv, if you're working without a script, we really don't get anywhere when we say no. We want to say yes and, we want to add to it, we want to explore and heighten. His yes and story and how it sort of spun into my story and then back to his story was maybe top five yes and stories of all time. Can I tell you about it?
Get started.
So Christopher admitted that he likes to drive fast. And he's become extremely familiar with the pattern of traffic lights in his neighborhood in Toronto. So he knows when to speed up or slow down so he can whip through the intersection, right? We've all kind of done this in our own worlds probably. So he's out driving on a dark and rainy night, which is already a good part of the story. He's coming to a hill, and he can see the light turn amber, which means it will turn to red, which means if he goes slow enough, by the time he gets to the intersection, he won't have to stop. He can whip right through. But for some reason that he's not even clear of to this day, he says to himself, no, I'm going to put on my brakes. And just as he reaches the intersection, a child runs right across the intersection. So if he had been doing the thing he was going to do, he would have killed that child. And Christopher says it was a life-changing moment for him, being aware of the power you have when you are thinking and not thinking. So he's telling the story to me, right, in real time, and he hadn't prepared it. And I can't get out of my head the fact that in my lifetime, I've hit two people with my car.
I didn't know that.
Nope. So the first was in Wilmette. I think I was around 19. And it was a four-way stop. I had stopped. I went to go turn left, and a bicyclist, like a 22, 23 year old. He just ran the stop sign and he crashed into my windshield. He was fine, broke my windshield. And when I got out of the car, he's like, that was completely my fault. I just didn't stop. I wasn't even looking. I'm going to go my way. You go your way. So I went and got the windshield repaired. He went, it really shook me up. And about 2 years later, I'm in Evanston on Main Street. And a little girl runs out between two cars. Tons of witnesses. I lightly tap her, right? So I get out immediately. She's fine. Tons of witnesses. But I like am sitting there at that point going, I am never going to hit someone again. And I haven't, thank God. So here's where Christopher started talking about how this connects to AI and ethics. So right now in the United States, autonomous vehicles are designed in such a way that if they know they're going to hit a group of people, like that's going to happen, they avoid hitting the smallest people, the kids. In Japan, it's the opposite. They are designed to avoid hitting the elderly. So here's the question. If I go to Japan and I rent an autonomous vehicle, can I tweak the moral parameters of how that car is designed so it won't hit a child? Or do I have to accept the ethical point of view of that culture and vice versa? And that's a profound idea that we don't necessarily think about when we think about AI and how it can affect our everyday activities. Because when we outsource our thinking, we're also outsourcing our morality and everything around that.
The title of the book and the guest you're referring to, Christopher DiCarlo, is Building a God, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence and the Race to Control It. Kelly Leonard is here, and he's talking about artificial intelligence. He just dropped another podcast at WGNradio.com and everywhere, getting to Yes And. He interviewed Christopher DiCarlo, a professor in Toronto, who wrote Building a God, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence and the Race to Control It. You just told us that the algorithm, I guess, for self-driving vehicles in America saves the small people.
Yeah.
Looks for them first. In Japan, it reveres the large people.
The elderly, yeah. And that's a cultural thing. I think most people know about that, right? In Asian cultures, have the respect for elders, and how in the United States, maybe it's a little bit different.
You wondered out loud, what if you could change the algorithm so that when you were driving, you happen to think small children deserve as much or more protection than the elderly?
Yeah, but I don't think that's going to happen.
But what's the point of that story?
So the point of that story is we need to think about AI. It's here. It's going to happen. And he says in the book that the range of the degree of danger lies somewhere between Y2K and Armageddon. So it could be.
But Y2K was a non-event.
Non-event.
Expensive repair, but a non-event.
Yeah.
And planes didn't fall out of the sky.
And Armageddon would be the other side of that.
Yes.
Right? But he says waiting to see what happens next is not an option we should tolerate. And I tend to agree with him. There's a concept he says that he writes about in the book that I had never heard of called the Frankenstein effect. Have you ever heard of this term? And he said it's basically art and culture warns us about these things. And when you think about Frankenstein, of course, being a monster that man built, I thought about the movie War Games. Remember that movie with Matthew Broderick?
Yeah.
When the only winning move is not to play. I love that. I thought about Blade Runner, being a movie that also confronts human beings becoming commodities. And then, of course, the big one is 2001, A Space Odyssey, with Hal.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, in advance of knowing what AI, you know, or even knowing if AI was going to be a thing, art and culture were sort of pointing to, hey, this could get out of control, you know, based on the things that we've known before. So shouldn't we put some rules of the road in place for this? And what Chris is saying, and what he feels his job is to point out, is that, no, we're not doing that. We are letting these folks run amok with it, and we don't know what's going to happen. And even if it potentially is going to be nothing, great. What's, you know, but the other side of that is terrible. So we need to get in there and get our hands on there. And I don't know, I mean, if you've benefited from any of this stuff. I had a hernia surgery, I don't know, a couple years ago. That was done by robotics, which was great. So those things are fantastic. But I know that my wife is a college professor, and she gets papers that she can tell were created by AI. And then she has to sort of confront that. And the fact is, if you're doing that as a student, you're not learning. So what's the point? So there's got to be ways that we can get in there and have some control over a kind of technology that we have no idea what could actually happen when it becomes generally intelligent.
Well, I understand how if we cede thinking to the robots, we diminish life and maybe the human experience. That sounds awful.
Yep.
Highfalutin, doesn't it? But can you be more specific about what the worst case scenario is? Like, okay, so some kids are dumber, or it's annoying, but what's the apocalyptic scenario?
Well, we become the ants. When the computers decide that, you know, we're insignificant, we're unimportant.
But, you know, but there'll always be machines on desktops. They're not actually going to be these robot armies that are going to come take us out of our houses and hurt us.
Think about how wired we are.
Play back that tape in 50 years, but
yeah.
I think I'll stand by that. I think we're over. Go ahead, Kelly.
Planes, cars. We've been talking about you. We were just talking about this. All of them have computers inside them. They could be falling out of the sky. They could be. Think about the various technology that our army is set up with. Weapons.
Okay, but if I may, so
yeah.
Planes falling out of the sky and then people die.
Mm-hmm.
But the implication here is that the computer wanted the plane to fall out of the sky to kill the people so the computer could reign supreme.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the computer want to do that? Or
I don't know. I don't want to find out.
And do you think that that's actually a plausible scenario?
Christopher DiCarlo does, and he's an expert in the AI field. Look, I'm an optimist. I'm a glass half full guy. When we talk about why Second City is going to be relevant in the age of AI, which is something we're discussing all the time
really?
With companies, sure, because we know that human beings are still going to be essential to the world of work. And what Second City does is teach people to use those things that are most human in terms of their ability to tell stories, to connect, to build relationships, that sort of things that the machines seemingly can't do or can't do as well as we do. We should be working with the technologies as opposed to ceding all our thinking to the technologies.
When Second City does a show, do you ask people to call out certain names, objects,
yeah.
things, and then everybody improvises around that?
Yeah.
Is it a scenario that you all think about that the three laptops will be there on tables and people will call out things and the computers will riff?
No.
They'll do improv?
Well, I got a funny story about that. So in the early 90s, when I was producing, there was a certain actor on stage who was interested in technology and he wanted to see what it would be like if we could get suggestions from the World Wide Web. So he had us hook up a computer, get us a bunch of extension cords, and then bring it out on a cart and then dial up on the modem AOL to ask for suggestions, which took forever. And
yeah.
and then the suggestions were all the things that you, the terrible suggestions that you would get from a terrible audience. That actor was Stephen Colbert. And it was a giant, giant failure. And what we've discovered over the years is, you know, the shortest distance between two people is a laugh. And if you put electronics in between that, that slows that thing down. So, you know, our work is not going to be improved creatively by technology. That doesn't mean this technology can't enhance all these other things that we do with our work. We've been talking to data scientists at the University of Chicago about what it would be like if AI could go into the archives at Second City and look at what America has been laughing at for the last 65 years. How cool would that be? You know, and it can measure things like that. It can measure the degree of laughter. And it knows, because if you can feed it certain kinds of data, it'll know what that material is about. Already, we've got technology, AI-fueled technology that I can search for. I had a Colleen, who's our head of marketing, asked me, he's like, can you give me like four scenes that mention Beyonce? And I'm like, I can't remember this. So I typed it in, and then those scripts came up. The AI did that. So amazing. We should use that. But there's this other side of the AI equation that Chris and other people are saying has cause for concern.
Well, if the, I don't mean to challenge you,
yep.
but if the artificial intelligence can write bogus book reviews and they get published in the Sun Times,
sure they do.
I wonder if they can't, if I say, okay, a pickle and a dump truck, and they meet at the street corner, what do they say? I don't know, would that be a prompt for you guys? I could see the two computers talking back and forth to each other and doing a Second City-styled skit.
Yeah. I may or may not have played with that myself.
And it's not funny yet?
I may or may have not discovered that it's not very funny. In part because the AI algorithm is built on matching patterns. So when I ask it for Beyonce, it's looking for Beyonce. But things that are funny at Second City are usually when you ask for Beyonce, but we supply you with something that's maybe a little unique or different that you didn't think about when you said Beyonce.
Yeah.
So it's not there yet. Could it get there? Maybe. I just don't. I don't see you and I wanting to go to a Jason Isbell concert where it's a computer. I want to see Jason Isbell, just like I want to see Second City actors perform when I go to Second City.
And that's Kelly Leonard, the Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at Second City, the Second City. He's the host of Getting to Yes and this is the thrust of his latest podcast, Getting to Yes And. It's at WGNradio.com. It's on the interwebs everywhere. Getting to Yes And with Kelly Leonard. Nice to see you, Kelly.
Good to see you.